You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group, www.americantheater.org.
Hello, and welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical. I'm Susie Evans, standing in for Editor-in-Chief Robert Reiner Kent, who's not joining us for this portion. You'll find out soon why. I'm the Senior Editor of American Theater, and I'm here with...
Deep Tran, Associate Editor.
Russ Denman, Production Editor.
And Gabe Cohn, Editorial Intern.
Our special guest today.
So Rob, who usually is sitting in the host chair, is not here today because we are our first segment today is going to be all about Harry Potter and Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. And Rob is not as into the Harry Potter world as the four of us. And so we have taken over. So and then later in the episode, we have an interview with Joy Meads of the Kilroys to talk about gender parity and the list that they've been putting out for 3 years and the importance of that in the theater, and then we'll join you back at the end with some recommendations. So for those of you who hear the word Harry Potter and don't want spoilers about Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, we're going to do a quick little overview, talk about our own relationship to Harry Potter, about the history of like Harry Potter on stage, and then we will come in, Deep Tran will come on and let you know what the time code is to fast forward to if you want to avoid any spoilers. For those of you who have read the play, have seen the play, enjoy. There's lots to geek out about, lots of twists and turns. So here we go. So how did everyone here love Harry Potter? Where does the Harry Potter fandom come from? Gabe?
I think it's a requirement just for my age group and my peers. I grew up going to the midnight releases in California and listening to the Jim Dale audiobooks, which we got on tape because they were like 10 or 20 bucks cheaper than CD. And I pretty much read this entire play in Jim Dale's voice.
Amazing. What about you, Russ?
I was a late comer. Other people my age came to the books much earlier than I did. And I was in the first year of college, and it was a loosely Holocaust-themed course for freshman comp. And the professor saw some parallels in Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix and the way that Death Eaters operate and the way Voldemort is treated and viewed as he who must not be named. There are connections there. It was a bit tangential, but it worked for the course.
I'm pretty sure that's what she based it on, too. Yeah. Like the whole Muggle thing, a mudblood thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so we were assigned the fifth book, and our professor was of the mind that you don't need to have read the first four books in order to read the fifth, which is not correct. And so I started reading the fifth, and I was following what was going on, but I'm going, I really need to read the other books. And so a friend of mine lent me all four, and I tore through them. And then I've been into Harry Potter since.
I think fifth or sixth grade were, no, I think it was sixth grade. I was 12. Our teacher started reading it to us during class, reading it aloud, because there was always like a book reading section he would read to us. And so he started reading Harry Potter, and then we all got into it. It was by like Prisoner of Azkaban. We were all just like, oh my God, no, don't stop, keep reading. And then as the books subsequently came out, I would read them like nonstop until I finished. And my mom would yell at me to go and eat dinner, and I would not want to do anything but finish reading. And just the seventh one, the tears came down my face, and it was a really intense time, guys.
Yeah, I came to them. I think first three books were out. I'm a little bit older than the main Harry Potter contingent, but I have two younger brothers, and they were really into it. And I remember we were on a camping trip, and I was bored and didn't want to play with my brothers. And my mom was like, well, these books are good. And we had the first three because those were out, and she gave me the first one. And I was like, well, this is good. So now I don't have to do anything but sit here in this tent and read these books. And then I went to all the release dates. Actually, when I went to the seventh one, when the seventh book came out, went to Barnes & Noble sign up, somebody had like gotten an advanced copy somehow or like read it really fast and drove by in a car and started yelling at everyone who died in that book.
I saw a YouTube video of someone doing that.
Oh my gosh. But I like didn't think it was real. Okay, spoiler alert if you haven't read the seventh book, but I hope everyone's listening to
No more spoiler alerts for books.
He was like screaming, and one of them was Dobie, and I was like, this can't be true. He's just making up names. And then I read the book, I'm like, they were all true.
Yeah. I was working at a camp when the sixth book came out, and there was one student there who liked me to read the books to her, so I was playing Jim Dale in that case.
Yeah.
Cool. So to Russ's point, we're going to talk a little bit about Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and I'm saying Russ because he said you didn't have to read the first four books to read the fifth book. Do you guys think you have to read all the books to read Harry Potter and the Cursed Child?
I would think so, or see the movies, or just be familiar with it, because they talk about a lot of characters who are in the books but do not show up in the play, like Neville Longbottom.
Spoiler, Neville's not in the play.
Spoiler, Neville's not in the play, but they talk about him a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you do too. So before we get into actual play, this is the first like official Harry Potter on stage. There was the Team Star Kid musical, a very Potter musical.
They did a parody.
Parody, yeah. With Darren Criss, kind of launched him to fame. But this is the first like J.K. Rowling, approved. She didn't write it, everyone. It was written by Jack Thorne, who wrote Let the Right One In. And it's directed in London by John Tiffany with movement and choreography by Stephen Hoggett, who, you know, have worked on everything from Glass Menagerie to
Once the Musical,
Blackwatch. That was their big first thing. They're very famous collaborating team. And I'm sure most of our listeners know them. But none of us here have seen the production. We have only read what's on the page.
We can't afford to go to London. American theater won't comp us.
And I think one of the things we were saying the other day about reading on the page is it's a very different reading experience than the books, because the stage directions are very sparse. The dialogue is pretty much just dialogue. There's not a lot of stage directions. DP, you were saying something about that the other day about the...
Well, for one thing, the stage directions are terrible and leave a lot to the imagination. I think there's a lot of statements saying that it's magical. There's this old people's home for old wizards, and they're describing it, and the descriptor is basically, it's magical, or it's terrifying, or it's lame. So if you're a director, there's a lot for you to work with, but if you're a reader who grew accustomed to having J.K. Rowling's very vivid descriptions of everything on the page, then you're basically missing out on half of the fun of the reading experience. And at the same time, you're really dependent on the dialogue, which it's very flat, and there's a lot of people telling you how they feel about something, or, you know, the story is about Harry Potter's middle son, Albus Severus, and he's talking about, oh, I hate my father because of XYZ. And so there's not a lot of subtext. I'm not entirely sure if that's how everyone else felt as they were reading it.
Well, two comments about that. The first is, like you're saying, the play does give a lot for directors to work with, and that's probably what they were going for, to give a lot of flexibility to directors. So there is something to be said for that, that this play, at least in this particular published script, was engineered with theater makers in mind. So
they also knew John Tiffany was going to be directing it when they were writing it, and he's a very imaginative director, so there's that.
Hi, guys. We're now going to get into a spoiler-filled discussion of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. So if you want to avoid spoilers, please skip ahead to 32-36. That's 32-36. Should we go over the plot?
I feel like saying anything about the plot is really a spoiler. It's about Harry Potter and his children and his second son's. It starts when his second son goes to Hogwarts and is nervous that he won't have the same experience that his dad had.
Yeah, it starts at the scene,
the epilogue
of the seventh
book. Yeah, it starts exactly when the seventh book ends.
And to your earlier point about needing to have a familiarity with the earlier stories, there is an emphasis in this dialogue of repeating things that came before, which to an avid Harry Potter fan might come off as forced or repetitive, but I suppose that that's in place in case there are people seeing the play or reading the play who have never encountered the series before.
Well, the other issue is like the okay, I'm just going to get into it. So the plot involves time travel. And so they time travel Albus and his best friend, Scorpius Malfoy, who is the son of his dad's arch nemesis,
Draco.
They always call him by his last name, so I never remember what his first name was. They go back in time. And so in going back in time, they revisit these very key characters within the Harry Potter series. You know, most notably Severus Snape and Dolores Umbridge. And I think if you didn't know who those characters are and how significant they were to the Harry Potter timeline and to fans, then I feel like the emotional heft of it would be lost. I mean, they recap why these characters are important. But
well, we should say why they go back in time to start off with. I mean, they go back in time because if you remember in the fourth book in the Triwizard Tournament, Harry Potter and Cedric Diggory both won and the end was a port key and it took them to Voldemort and Voldemort killed Cedric and he couldn't kill Harry. And so the play starts with Cedric's father, who's in this old wizard's home, coming and saying, I know there's one time travel. You have to remember, I think it was the third book where Hermione used it to go to classes. Third book. Hermione had a time travel so she could take as many classes because she was an overachiever and they banned them. They banned them because they were dangerous and there was one left.
And actually, it wasn't banned. It was destroyed in book 5 when they all went to the Ministry of Magic. There was a room of time turners and it all crashed to the floor.
Yeah. So there's one left. And Cedric's dad knows he has it and he's a dying man. He wants to bring his son back. Harry and Hermione, who's now the Minister of Magic, and Harry, who's works in the ministry.
He's the defense.
Yeah. Say, no, it's too dangerous. Harry's second son is a little bit of a rebel. He wants to do something to impress his dad, to do something he hates, Hogwarts. He decides to steal the time turner and with his friend.
You just brought up one point where I thought the motivations for the character were completely...
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
he has no motivation to steal that time turner and go back.
Or to jump off the train to begin. It was like, okay, so he's rebelling against his dad by jumping off the train to Hogwarts and breaking
into the Ministry of Magic, like a high security place, using Polyjuice Potion to look like his dad. So this is a teenager who like breaks the law basically to go in and steal this very valuable, dangerous device because he wants to impress his dad. But
he doesn't have that sophisticated magic to do all the things that he does to break in.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the things. Like, because in the original books, the trio hatches this whole plan to break into the Ministry of Magic, and that happens, and it's like a whole saga of them, like,
figuring out,
an Ocean's 11 sort of way, like planning the entry and everything. And then this, it's kind of just like, oh, take some Polyjuice Potion, you're in. It was just kind of
the same thing. Oh, look, I turned you into my dad so quickly.
Yeah.
We should also add, before we get to the biggest spoiler of the episode, that it's Scorpius, who is Draco's son, Albus, who is Harry's son, and their new friend, Delphi Diggory, who they meet through Amos, who comes to join them, is kind of encouraging them on this journey to go back in time.
But she's kind of a bystander. She just lets them go back. She doesn't actually go back.
She doesn't go back. She was going to, and then they said she wouldn't blend in because they're going back to Hogwarts and she's older. She's not a student age. I think they're 4th years because the Triwizard Tournament's 4th years, so they can blend in when they go back to the Triwizard.
Or just because they needed all that time to build up the resentment between Albus and his son. No, it's really funny because in the beginning, it starts with Albus's first year and him feeling really out of place. And then there's like a scene where like they fast forward through 3 years worth of character development. And I don't really know how it looks on the stage, but just reading it on the page, you get the sense that you're missing out on a lot of really important things that would give some backstory motivation for this growing detachment between Harry and his son. And instead, you don't have that. You just have the character saying, my dad doesn't really acknowledge my existence.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's like that part is glossed over, and then so quickly, you know, halfway through the part one, we're already back in the Triwizard tournament. I thought it was sort of telling that we're back in like the original story so quickly, because you know we don't even have time to get comfortable in the present, and they don't spend that much time there because they know this is. Or I don't know if they know or not, but it feels like, okay, well, this new part is less interesting. Let's go back.
Well, that's what was my biggest, not complaint really, because I was entertained by it, but it almost the whole play takes place with the Time Turner in events that have already happened in the Harry Potter books. It was almost as if J.K. Rowling said, you can't create any new characters except this one, Delphi, which we'll agree on, who becomes very important. You can't really create any new scenarios. But you can twist scenarios that have already happened.
Yeah.
Like, the whole thing takes place and, like, they go back to, you know, Privet Drive, and they go back to the forest, and they go back to the Triwizard Tournament, and they go back to... They go to all these scenarios with times travel that they have already happened.
Right, yeah. Right.
It's basically, like, rewriting the Harry Potter stories.
The way I mentioned it to my friends, it's basically, like, fan fiction for one, but it's also like fan service, the play, or Harry Potter and the Massive Fan Service. Because what is, in lieu of actual character development and seeing like what the trio has become and like what, and what this new generation is like, we only get to know like two and a half characters in this new generation. And the rest of the time we're spent looking at events that already happened. And so my question is, what then is the point of the overall theme seems to be like father, son, parent, children
friendship
issues. I mean, it's great to do that. I think theater is a perfect medium in order to really, you know, get into a person's head and to really explore character relationships and development. And I don't really think it's conducive to adventure, like movie type, fantasy type, you know, adventuring and going off and doing things.
I think part of the reason the whole theme is father, son, parent, child is because the oldest of the Harry Potter fans have kids of their own now. And so there's that generation of like, that would be my theory. Like, I don't know, probably my age and older are like in that Harry Potter fandom still, and they have kids of their own. And so they have a way to both introduce the Harry Potter story to this new generation and keep the fandom going, and also to like pull on the heartstrings of the fans who grew up with it and are now introducing their children to it.
But then why not just make a play about like just how shitty Harry is as a father? Because I do believe he would be a bad father because he never had like a proper father figure. And so, like, why just not make a play about that? That could easily fill up 6 hours worth of time if you just explore the relationships that these characters have with their kids.
So I think the lack of narrative movement, so to speak, is one of the reasons why this story is so well suited for theater. Because as we all know, theater is ephemeral. And so the whole thing is that it's really just happening in that one moment. And it's recreated every night and it never happens again, technically. And so this whole idea of time travel, of going back and forth and really not making any progress in a way, fits theater in a way that another medium, wouldn't work. There's this adage about George S. Kaufman and the idea that the curtain comes down just before, there's any possibility of change. And so that's kind of what's going on here. This idea that all of these things happen just to return back to where you started.
But you don't. I mean, you don't return anywhere forward in the new present, but you mean Harry and his son have a better relationship?
Yes. Oh, speaking of relationships.
Do you want to bring up the biggest spoiler of the whole play now?
No. But did everyone, as you were reading it, did everyone get like, very homosexual vibe between Albus and Severus.
Oh, yeah.
There are complaints that was not developed. Actually, I saw one headline that names two of the characters, so I guess that kind of spoiler is okay.
Yeah. I definitely got those vibes, but I knew they weren't going to go there.
And my question is, why don't you go there? You've already laid down the foundation for it. Because there's this, like, there's a scene.
Because Dumbledore is gay.
Yeah. Dumbledore is gay, but it's never acknowledged in the wizarding world. It's only, like, Rowling saying it, you know, post facto. And so why not just make these two boys, like, why don't we develop that? And why don't we make that a plot point or make that a point of character motivation?
I wonder how it reads on stage, though. I wonder if it reads, I mean, it could be read differently on the page than it did on the stage.
That is true, though there's a stage direction where they're, Albus and Severus are separated by Harry because Harry thinks, you know, Severus is a bad influence on his son.
So, Scorpius.
Of what? Scorpius. Blah. So Scorpius and Albus are separated, and then they have a scene on the stair where they, on these stairs where they break up, and then they have subsequent scenes where they walk past each other on the stairs and they're looking at each other like very heartbroken.
Yeah, there is that whole scene where they look longingly at each other. What are you going to say, Gabe?
I was going to say I got the vibes. I think, yeah, there's an argument to be made that I don't think there's anything said that overtly makes it clear, but I think there's enough there that especially, and there's also the point with the hugging.
Mm-hmm, there's a lot of hugging
because that's like a huge part of the dynamic of the relationship, and that is never really brought full circle. I mean, I guess at one point it's Albus hugging Scorpius, and then
it reverses,
it flips.
Yeah, it's like Scorpius doesn't like to be touched because he doesn't have a lot of, you know, Malfoy doesn't really hug his son apparently,
but he does at the end of the play, doesn't
exactly.
he?
Exactly. So like he develops, like he learns to let in human affection.
Yeah,
but I think my point with the whole like LGBT aspect is like there's so many fans of Harry Potter who grew up with these books and who are yearning for that kind of representation. And there is this big opportunity, maybe not even make it a plot point, just like this big opportunity to acknowledge that. And instead it's very heteronormative and really kind of sexist because, like, do we need another tale of two young white boys saving the world and having the women just be on the sidelines cheering them on or like being a mom or like
Hermione is the Minister of Magic
and she's a side character. She doesn't do anything during the play. She just stands there waiting for shit to happen.
This is the point where we should bring up the spoiler of spoilers.
Spoilers. Oh yeah, do it.
So Delphi, the one new character, I think she's the only new character the kids who were introduced. And then you realize, I think it's not till the second part of the play.
The fourth act.
That she has been manipulating them the entire time because she is actually the daughter of Voldemort and she wants to go back in time and make it so that he never tried to kill Harry so that his powers would never be diminished and that the Dark Lord would rule all.
And so that she could also meet her father.
And so she can meet her father. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like a Darth Vader type moment when she, like, so there's like some sympathetic where you're like, oh, she really wants to meet her father.
Well, but my point is, it's like we're living in like post Star Wars, like, what was the newest movie?
Force Awakens,
where you have, you know, a hero who is a woman and a hero who's also a black man. And so we're living in this very diverse world and now we're looking at, and the newest Harry Potter book is this regressive, you know, the woman is, the lead woman is evil, the heroes are two little white boys.
Hey,
and the
we don't get a female villain very often either.
It had sort of like a Bond girl kind of turnaround too when she turns on them because she like expressly says in one line like, oh, young men are so easy to manipulate. Yeah. And it felt a lot like, you know, that the Bond kind of trope of the henchman's girlfriend seducing Bond and then turning on him and then ending up getting defeated by the heroic James Bond. It felt sort of like that to me.
And then she unveils her plot in one grand speech, and then you can almost hear her cackling.
Yeah, yeah, there was a lot of exposition. I feel like I'm still giving it the benefit of the doubt, though, because I feel like it's different on stage.
Maybe.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
Is the gender politics even, like, is that even worth giving it the benefit of the doubt? I mean, it's not like it passes the Bechdel test. Like, no woman ever...
Never two women on stage together talking to each other.
Yeah, and there's really, like, the powerful women are sidelined. It's just these, the tale of
it
these
is interesting
boys
because the whole series was written by a woman.
Yeah.
And this is the first story written by a man.
Yes. Even though the story is credited to Rowling and to Tiffany and to Thorne, yeah. it was, as Susie mentioned earlier, written by Thorne exclusively.
And also, if we want to just on the point of Hermione being minister, in part of the time travel, part of these kind of time travel periods that we get, there's one that is that alternate reality, in which Hermione never marries Ron, and she's like a bitter professor.
Oh yeah, she's like this old spinster.
Yeah,
she becomes Snape,
right?
Basically because yeah. She never married Ron, and so she never married anyone. And that's why women become bitter,
exactly.
Because no one ever loved them.
Yeah,
and yeah. I just wanted a woman who was an actual main character who was another Hermione. Like, and I feel like her daughter could have been that, but she wasn't.
But then I felt like when her daughter was on stage, they were just using the exact same tropes of Harry, Ron, and Hermione, and I was like, oh, look, another two boys, one girl threesome back at Hogwarts. That felt very rote to me.
Yeah, but then Albus has a younger sister, and so they could have made
her. Yeah, they did nothing with Harry's other children,
no.
James and Lily.
No, I don't even, I didn't even remember what they were called.
Yeah, well, they're named after his parents.
Oh, right.
Ginny had no say in any of this naming.
yeah, well, Ginny had no say in anything in this play.
That's my biggest problem with Harry Potter. Why did he marry Ginny?
I don't know. I liked her.
I don't like Ginny.
I had no problems with her.
She's very side character in this, but she is a journalist.
Yeah, she works for the sports pages.
They all have good jobs.
They do.
Good for them.
See, I would have liked to learn more about their lives instead of just revisiting stuff that already happened.
Yeah.
Gabe, you look like you have something to say.
I have this in my notes. The trolley witch.
Oh, yeah.
Can we just... Because when you said your favorite character, I was like, Trolley Witch was my... Because was the most absurd.
Get a play about her.
Isn't she... Was she on in the original books?
She's the girl. She's the old woman
that
pushing
gives
the cart.
Like, the buzz, the beans.
Anything off the trolley, dear.
Yeah, the candy.
When she comes on top of the train
she's
and like...
Wolverine. Yeah.
She's like freaking Terminator. Yeah. Like, she'll just like follow you.
But then I wonder when she becomes Wolverine, how did they get off the train?
Yeah, that's the other
thing. That's pretty amazing.
Like, all these people have tried and failed to get off the train, and then they just jump off the train.
Will get off on my watch.
It was almost like they didn't need her to do that because they were going to get off either way. So like they just needed to create drama. So like, let's turn the car to Charlie Witch.
It was ridiculous. It was so ridiculous. And it sort of felt like, one of these... I questioned the new angles that we got on things in the original. I just questioned whether they were actually, adding to the original world. And I don't think they were. It sort of felt to me all the parts that were... even like the things that were the same, like seeing the Triwizard Tournament and having Ludo Bagman, which is a name I'd forgotten... all these things sort of feel like
to be funny.
Yeah.
Was it the same words they said in the book? They said
I was wondering that.
I think it is.
I think so.
Yeah.
It may have been a mix.
They were pretty faithful about that. There were even things that it's like, well, did they just make up Moaning Myrtle's full name? No, it was in a tweet from a year ago.
A tweet?
A tweet of J.K. Rowling?
No.
Yeah.
Her name's really Myrtle Elizabeth Warren?
Yes.
That pulled me out of it.
Totally pulled me out of it.
I don't know.
You're saying, Gabe?
Yeah, to me, these it sort of felt like... My comparison was it felt like getting a guided tour of a place I grew up in. You know, it felt like some things have changed and we're seeing some new angles on things. We're seeing... we're getting... Like, new light is shed in certain places, but it just doesn't... It doesn't have the same... sort of discovery, and it doesn't have, I don't know, the same... There were only a few times... also, this applied to, I thought, the characters and the dialogue between the familiar characters. I thought that there were only a few... there were only a few moments where I felt like, oh, this is kind of how... This has the spark that I sort of remember. And honestly, most of them revolved around, like, Ron making jokes because like, oh, that I remember that, you know. That
but dynamic. Ron wasn't as into the jokes as his brothers were.
Was yeah.
He? That kind of felt like they just turned him into, like, a conglomerate Weasley.
Yeah.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Yes,
that's true. I didn't think about it. Yeah, that way.
Well, because one of his brothers died in the Battle of Hogwarts.
And they won't even acknowledge that. They won't actually even acknowledge, like, all the other people who died.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I want to see Lupin.
I wanted to see Lupin!
Yeah.
Like, out of... Okay, that's why I hate Albus so much, because out of all the people he could have gone back in time to save, Sirius or Lupin and Tongs, like the parents of Harry's godson, who was an orphan after the war because his parents died, or Mad-Eye, like all of these other people. No, it's Cedric.
It had to be the Triwizard Tournament, though.
Why?
Because that's when Voldemort came back to power.
Yeah, but that's not why he did it. Albus said he did it because he wants to save Cedric so that his Cedric's dad could have his son.
Albus's
back,
motivation was a big problem.
Bad writing. It's all I'm saying.
But yeah, what his goal wasn't to defeat evil. It was, I think, the singular goal was to save Cedric because he said, like, this was this big mistake my father made, and I'm going to right it by saving Cedric.
But in the one scenario where they saved Cedric, that's when it became the Dark Lord, because Cedric kills Cedric becomes evil because he's so embarrassed by losing, and he kills Neville Longbottom.
Hilarious.
Who is like, he was a nobody. And I was like, no, he was supposed to, you know, who did he kill in the Battle of Hogwarts?
He killed the snake.
Oh, Nagini.
And the Nagini and the snake had to die for Voldemort. And so now Neville's dead. The whole world's down.
Yeah.
I hate time travel. I feel like it's such a lazy thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, side note, apparently at some point, Rowling said that there are all kinds of LGBTQ people at Hogwarts, and it would be good to see more of them.
Well, there's no stories about them, though. They might be there, but there's no stories about them.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, she can say whatever she wants. She could say, oh, I have representation because I have these two side Asian characters, but they're still side Asian characters.
Right.
They're not given voice. The ones who are giving voice and motivations are these two, like, very white boys. And so I don't buy it anymore. Force Awakens. Force Awakens has increased my expectations for popular entertainment. So it's like, I can't.
Yeah.
I can't accept this.
I agree with you, Deep. I was saying that because she mentions that they're there, they should have more visibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm.
So
anyway, at least it's written by a woman.
Would we see this? Would we pay $200?
I would see this 100%.
Yeah, there's so many things, especially the magic. There are so many things that are left to the imagination, for better or for worse. Like the spells, I didn't know how those function. And also tacking onto the spell thing, we were talking earlier about whether, you need to have read the other books or be familiar. That's one place where I thought, like, you're expected to know what Crucio means.
And Avada Kedavra, you have to know. Because when she says it, everyone's like, oh,
yeah.
You don't know, that's the killing spell.
Yeah.
But what's nice, at least about that spell, is that the reaction from people on stage will indicate the gravity of that curse.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I think if you're new to Harry Potter and you read this play, you wouldn't really know what everything signifies.
That's true.
So I think the reading experience, I think, was more for book fans and movie fans, and I think the play experience is really going to be a lot more holistic.
Well, yeah, I can't wait to see it. I really want to see it, even if it has problems. I think we're good. Well, now we're going to go into, after that big heated discussion you stayed for all of it, we're going to go into our interview with Joy Meads of the Kilroys, and we'll be back after the interview. Hello, everyone. We're here today with one of our favorite people at American Theater, Joy Meads. She's the literary manager and artistic engagement strategist at Center Theater Group in Los Angeles. But she's here today to talk about her work with the Kilroys, which is the Los Angeles-based group of playwrights, dramaturgs, literary managers, producers, working towards achieving gender parity in the nonprofit theater community. If you haven't heard about the Kilroys' work, they survey the field every year. I believe this was their third year, and take nominations of plays written by women or trans, female or trans playwrights. And they get nominations, and the most nominated plays become this list called The List that they distribute. And all the plays are unproduced. They haven't had a production yet, which I believe is different it's been in the past. Yeah. Before it was, they could have had one production, right? Mm-hmm. Why did you make that change?
The reason why we made that change is, you know, we're interested in, as we've established the gesture of the list every year, I think we're interested in kind of taking a different angle into the problem, keeping things at least a little bit fresh and new, and re-getting attention by focusing on different aspects of it. So the first year, we wanted to include plays that had one production because the problem of gender disparity in the theater includes plays that have been produced before. You know, whatever that 22% figure, that includes, you know, those plays that get 14 productions.
Yeah.
You know,
and the 22% is the number of plays written by women or trans playwrights that have been produced at nonprofit theaters from 2013 to 2016. And that was gathered by the Lilies and the Dramatists Guild, I believe.
I might be off by a percentage.
I think you're right. It's 22%. I might be off on the actual seasons, but it's the last three seasons that they did it for.
Before 2016. So I think it was 2012 to 2015.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, as we've been kind of like looking at the issue of gender disparity, which we're all fascinated by and kind of obsessed with, you know, we see a lot of different factors that contribute to it. And so the idea that we would have plays with one production would, was recognizing that, you know, the problem isn't just getting produced the first time. The problem is getting those second, third, fourth productions that, make a play canonical, you know, that maybe lead it to be revived in the future. And in fact, you know, the play that was at the top of the list last year, Claire Barron's You Got Older, it's play, it got 20 nominations. It had a really successful Off-Broadway run. I think it got an Obie.
Yeah, I think Reed Birney got an, did he get an Obie? Or the play got an Obie?
I think the play got an Obie. Yeah. Very, very warm reviews, very successful at the box office. As far as I know, there's yet to be a second production of that play.
Seriously?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
But it was on the list last year. It had been produced, or it had been produced?
No, it had been produced that one time. We did decide to make this change this one year for two reasons. One is that because we included plays that had gotten a single production, we were seeing a lot of geographic concentration in New York, quite frankly, of plays. And we thought that having a year where we say unproduced only would actually distribute the nominated plays more evenly across the country. And then the other reason is that, you know, we were thinking about one aspect of the issue of why women and female and trans playwrights don't get produced. I want to back up a second and say, like,
yeah, go for it.
I think one of the things we wanted to do with the list is to clearly establish what the problem isn't, right? And what the problem isn't is those things that I think that we've been hearing that people have believed, you know, from artistic directors and producers over all of the years as the reasons why they aren't producing plays by women. And I think they have been absolutely sincere in their belief when they say the plays just aren't out there, or, you know, we only produce the best plays, right? And they have believed that those are the issues. And there are a variety of reasons why they believe that, but it's actually absolutely not the case. And I knew that from all of my years of reading plays, you know, in literary management capacities. And so what we wanted to do with the list is to establish that those, explanations that we've been hearing all these years, I think, you know, very sincerely, actually, that the facts on the ground, don't match those explanations. And so we wanted to stop talking about the false answers, you know, to establish there actually are many plays every year that are written by women and trans playwrights, and that there are excellent plays every year written by those playwrights. And so that we could start to talk about what the actual problems are, right? And so this idea of this year focusing on unproduced plays, I think one of the things that we were thinking about is one of the, obstacles to production that occurs. You know, I think there's probably about close to 100 very subtle factors that all combine to create this problem. And one of them is, I think that it is harder for a play by a woman or a trans playwright to get that first production. And there's some evidence in, studies that they've done in other fields that, you know, male applicants or candidates for a position tend to get hired on the basis of potential, mm-hmm. whereas women are hired on the basis of, you know, proven experience, right?
Yeah.
And, there isn't that kind of research directly on, you know, plays getting produced, but yeah. I believe I've anecdotally seen, you know, throughout my career at, you know, observing at a variety of theaters, and talking to friends from across the country that there are, you know, when you have a first production of a play by a woman or a trans playwright versus a male playwright, that it's much easier to get for the producers to kind of get taken away with excitement about the potential and everything that's working in the play. And mm-hmm. with a female or the trans writer, maybe they start to worry more about the risk factors.
Definitely.
So yeah. That's one of the things that we're thinking about, so what are some of the barriers to getting that first production? And then in the future, maybe we'll explore other barriers towards production of women through the focus of the list.
Yeah. Were there any other things that changed this year for the list? This is your third year. This year, you released some stats of like encouraging numbers that the list has done over the past three seasons. But what were some things that maybe changed this year and some encouraging information that you got this year with the list?
So, well, one thing that changed is that we continue to expand our list of nominators. We actually allow people to self-nominate to become a nominator for the list by just emailing us. There's a link on our website. And the criterion is that you have to have seen or read 40 plays a year. And through that, I think we've seen we have a different list of nominators this year. We have a more geographically diverse list, and we have a list that's reflects a greater diversity of aesthetic. You know,
do you have returning nominators who've done mm-hmm. it multiple
we
years?
We do.
Yeah, so you allow
people
that.
Have done it all 3 years. Wow. Yeah,
and there's no cap on how many nominators you can have, right?
No, yeah. I mean, I think that the data set just gets stronger the mm-hmm. more people that contribute.
Yeah,
so that's one change. So we've had some really exciting signs of success. We did a survey of our playwrights this year, and we asked them, you know, if they had an increase of interest in the script, if it had gotten produced. And of the respondents, 80% of them report a subsequent production, and at some of some really prestigious theaters, and 95% of them reported noticing a marked increase of interest in the script. Mm-hmm. We know that people have gotten agents based on the list. We know of a number of theater companies who have told us that they make their summer reading list, like going down and reading all of the plays from the list. And we've heard from a number of artistic directors that they have chosen plays because they first read about them on the list. It's an encouraging sign that our basic thesis was right, which is that we believe that there's no one in the American theater that wants to be biased against women and trans playwrights, right? Yeah. We don't think there's anybody who's like determined to maintain the dominance of male voices on the stage, you know? It's just that it's complicated to solve the problem. I think if it were easy to solve it, we would have done it a long time ago. And I think that it requires that, you know, people really become aware of some systemic biases, some unconscious biases that are really invisible to us unless we make an effort to see them.
Yeah. So you had 569 plays were nominated this year.
Yes.
And 32 made it on the final list, and those received between 5 and 14 nominations. And then 82 plays were given honorable mentions, which received 3 to 4 nominations. Is this a shorter list than it's been in past years, 32, or is it about the same?
Yeah. What we encountered was that there was a massive jump between, what was it? It was four nominations?
Yeah, four, three to four was your honorable mention.
Oh, that's right.
Five,
okay.
Five and
so
up.
So counting five and up, we had 32. And then if we wanted to count four and up, it would have been something like 70.
Oh my gosh.
And so we had the biggest, longest, most passionate debates about this, you know, and we eventually came to a kind of consensus, but, we believe that we want to keep the list to a length where we believe that people will read them all and where it, you know, where it seems manageable and not overwhelming. And so that's why we have, you know, the main list and then the honorable mention section, because it provides more plays for, those who really want to deep dive and read broadly. You know, you can read all of those plays, and I really recommend that people do, because, you know, each one of the plays on the honorable mention list was nominated as one of the most excellent of the year by at least three people, you know, who are new play professionals. So I definitely recommend that people do. But so people who want to deep dive do have that that available to them, but we're not overwhelming people who aren't going to do that.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that as the Kill Race is around longer, your list isn't getting shorter. Like, it could be longer next year, but like, it's almost a little bit more competitive to get on the list.
It is more competitive to get on the list. Yeah. Because we have, I guess we have more nominators. And also I think the unproduced criterion meant that, you know, there were fewer plays that, like, you know, a whole ton of people had gone to see this production and really loved it, right? You know, mm-hmm. So we really were relying on people just having read the script. And so there was a broader swath of plays nominated. But yeah, the first year, I think the list was three nominations and up, right?
And there were like 50 or 60 on the first list, right? Or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, it was 46 plays on the first version of the list and 53 on the second version.
Yeah. And you do the list and the honorable mentions every year.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, which is great. And there were some plays on the play that we talked a lot at the beginning about the unproduced criteria this year. Mm-hmm. There were some plays that maybe hadn't been produced, they were nominated, but had a production by the time the list was announced, right? I'm thinking of Martina Mayock's Cost of Living was on the list this year, and she was produced at Williamstown this summer, just this past June.
Yeah, I think we decided to cut it off that by the date that the list went live, it couldn't have had a production. For a couple of reasons. One is that it takes us a while to organize the list and get all of the blurbs together. And, you know, it seems horrible to tell a playwright, like, oh, hey, you're on the list. And then they get a production and we have to take them off before it goes live, you know? Yeah. So that's one thing. Another thing is that sometimes plays get announced for production and those productions don't happen.
That's
so we decided as long as it literally had not been produced by the day that the list went live, we would consider it eligible.
Yeah. What about in terms of repeat playwrights on the list, new playwrights you're seeing each year? How often are you getting new playwrights on the list each year? Is a lot of the same people every year? What's kind of the discovery of new writers in that regard?
There are new writers on the list every year, and it's really joyful to see. And, you know, part of what the list represents is just the zeitgeist at a given moment. So it's what have people been reading over the past 12 months. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you'll see, you know, new writers that are new to the list, but writers that are long beloved for us, you know, theater people who are in the Kilroys, right? You just get a different swath every year, depending on who, you know, who's been read. I think the first year, the, names were more familiar because it was the first year. So I think sometimes people had, you know, plays that had just been kicking around for a while that they loved, that they didn't understand why they weren't getting produced, you know, that went on there. But once a play is on the list, it's no longer eligible to be on the list anymore. And hopefully because it's been produced a lot, but also because we want to have different plays every year. When we went to people a year later, they didn't have, you know, that backlog of all of those plays that, you know, their favorite plays for forever that they want to get produced, you know, they have to really talk about what they've read in the last 12 months. And then exciting.
So it has to be something they've read in the last 12 months, you think?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And we've always asked that, but I think, you know, people may have fudged it a little bit that first time. I'm not sure. But
Yeah. Well, they didn't know what it was the first time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and then the other thing that happened this year is, I don't know if it was because of the expanded list of nominators or if it was because of the unproduced criteria, but we had a much larger amount of playwrights on the list this year who didn't have agents. I think it was something like a third. I should probably confirm that.
But it was a larger amount.
Yeah, it was a much larger amount. Like in the past, we've had one or two playwrights mm-hmm. without agents, which makes sense. I mean, if really what the list is measuring is like who's getting read, having somebody whose job it is to send your plays around and make sure that they get read mm-hmm. is definitely going to help you get on the list. But this year, for some reason, we were able to, like the data that came up, we had a lot of unrepresented writers on the list, which just made us very, very happy.
Why do you think that is? That was actually my next question. Was more regional diversity of nominators or?
Yeah, I think perhaps it's, I think there's a couple of answers. One is that I do think that the fact that we expanded the list of nominators and that we have more geographic diversity probably plays into it. I think the fact that we asked for unproduced plays plays into it. And I think the fact that this is the third time around, and so a lot of the more known plays have gotten on the list before and hopefully been produced. I think that's all part of it. But another factor is something that we're thinking about a lot as a group, which is that the systemology of the list privileges early career playwrights, actually. For a couple of reasons. One is that mid-career playwrights are more likely to be writing plays that are commissions and therefore less likely to be read widely, right? Their unproduced plays are probably, really known to people at a certain theater and not as known beyond that. So that's one factor. Another factor is that when playwrights are new on the scene, I think they're agents, if they have them, push them really, really hard. And I think there can be a kind of mid-career doldrums, right? For once you get past that emerging spot. And also there's a lot of opportunities for visibility for emerging playwrights, whether it's, awards or, fellowships. There's a lot of visibility for emerging playwrights that aren't there for mid-career playwrights necessarily. We're thinking about this a lot because I think there's a particular challenge when it comes to female playwrights for that mid-career period, because often that's a time when some women, if they're going to have children, they're having children around that time. And that represents an additional hurdle, right, for them to get their work seen. I know that you guys have covered this issue, but there are a number of the new play festivals that where you can't bring kids, where childcare is an issue.
Especially
right?
The summer ones, too.
Especially the summer ones. Now, a lot of them are really working
yeah.
to address that. So Space at Rider Farm is doing this amazing thing. I know that Wendy Goldberg at the O'Neill is working to make sure that nobody ever can't come because they have a child to care for. But it remains an issue for most of these opportunities to get your work seen. So it's something that we're thinking about and trying to figure out how do we really address that and make sure that we are taking care of female and trans writers who are past the emerging phase of their career, which might happen through the context of the list or it might happen in a totally different way. It's just something that we're thinking about. I think it's a real danger zone for female writers.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, this is not, we talked about this a little bit in your question, but I'd be curious to explore it a little bit more. The whole barrier to entry into the theater field is hard as a woman and a man, just getting in, getting an agent, getting into MFA program, that's getting right. your play on people's desks. Are there ways you're considering? Obviously, you always have professional nominators who are reading plays, mm-hmm. and you had more playwrights who didn't have agents this year. But one of the points of the list back to the emerging is it's also just a discovery tool for discovering new writers. Are you doing anything? Have you put thought towards, different kinds of nominators, different ways of discovering writers or that sort of thing?
Well, we've tried to do the different kinds of nominators in a very, very systematic way. So the first year that we did it, we really emailed people that we had personal relationships with and we thought would open our emails and actually take the time to nominate us when, we had never done this before. And, in our experience with the subject of gender parity in the past, it has not been something that people have been eager to discuss. That's totally changed within the last several years. But I remember years of going to conferences where there'd be panels on gender parity, and I'd be sitting among people that I, you know, love and respect, who'd be kind of like sighing and rolling their eyes and being like, no, we all know this. We all know this, right? And yet it wasn't changing. Mm-hmm. So, in our experience, people had really not been eager to talk about the subject of gender parity. And we thought everybody would probably think that this was a little bit of a pain in the ass, but would do it because they like us. I mean, we knew that we would have some allies who would be like, you know, yes, you know, burn bras, whatever. we expected to have to fight a little bit more to get intention and goodwill. And we've been delighted to see that that absolutely wasn't the case. But so the first year, just people we knew and thought would reply to our email. And then the second year, we worked with the National New Play Network, and a few other people to expand the list beyond people that we knew and make sure that we were really getting all of these theaters that produce new plays across the country, of different sizes, right? And make sure that all those folks are really well represented. And we made sure that we were including culturally specific theaters, that we were including theaters that had, did more aesthetically non-traditional work. We really worked on that first year. And then we also opened up the list to self-nomination. So the second iteration, I think, was way more inclusive than the first. And then this third year has been even better. Now, we didn't do the same kind of effort because we'd kind of like turned over every rock that we knew of, you know, and looked in every, you know, made every connection, that we could think of that second year. But as we've gotten more known, we've made sure that every time that we talk about this anywhere, that we're talking about the fact that, you know, we really encourage people to self-nominate as readers, mm-hmm. you know, which we do, and to say, go to our website, you know, information about how to do that is right there, thekilroys.org.
Yeah.
And we had 60, 80 self-nominators this year, which was great.
This was the first year they self-nominated, or last year too?
Last year they could too, but, this year I think we made more of a push to try and really get the word out about that.
Yeah.
So.
Cool. It's exciting. Are there ways that you talked a little bit about this with expanding your range of nominators. Are there ways you're trying to increase, or I haven't even looked at the list intently from this view, other areas of diversity on the list as well?
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty excited about the, I think the list has gotten more diverse every year,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it has really been intentional for us. We're just making sure that we're being thoughtful and intentional about reaching the field of work as it actually exists instead of, you know, the places that are obvious to go to and that, you know, that we have come across before for whatever reasons, that we're not just depending on our own personal histories, but we're really trying to be rigorous about reaching out mm-hmm. to the field as it exists. And that's really, I think, made a difference. I think it's a very, very diverse list. I think it is the field of talent that I know is out there, the extraordinary vibrancy and diversity of writers working today, the excellence. We are in a golden age of the American theater, y'all, and yeah. American playwriting. So that's been really exciting to see.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the catchwords that we had for ourselves as a group is we wanted to think in terms of disruption, right? We wanted to think in terms of, like, we think that there's a big power in trying to interrupt, like, kind of patterns that continue through inertia and invite people to see things in through a different way, you know? And so we're trying to think about how we can make sure that the list doesn't become just background noise, that people don't get used to it, that it doesn't become less effective as a tool for conversation starting,
mm-hmm.
And also in the rest of our work. So what else can we do to move the field forward? You know, one thing that we did for the first time this year was this cake drop,
mm-hmm.
which we had one day where we had identified gosh, I think it was 14 theaters in different cities across the country, who were just doing an excellent job of producing at parity and better, right? And we contacted bakeries in all of those cities and, we got playwright secret agents, on board, and we just delivered, asked our secret agents to deliver a cake to that theater in the city with the names of the playwrights they're producing that year on it and to take a photo. And what we wanted to do with that is to, you know, we think that there's a big power in, showing success and what success looks like and putting that as an image in people's heads, you know, and to celebrate the fact that it's happening all the time and that it's actually really easy to do it.
Yeah.
But it was just this wonderful, joyful day where we had these pictures that were coming in all day with like these smiling administrators and playwrights, like eating cake together. And it was also fun to celebrate the people who really are doing the work every day, you know, and who don't always get recognized for it.
Yeah.
So that was really fun. We read a study, that we talked about a lot our first year before we had, the first iteration of the list that really informed our approach, which was, I hope I'm going to quote this right. So it was a study where basically they took a bunch of managers who had to make hiring decisions, and they gave them a group of resumes and asked them to choose somebody for a position, right? And there were three conditions in the study. One condition is that they were given no instruction other than choose the best candidate for this position. The second condition was that they were told choose the best candidate for this position. And by the way, you know, racial and gender bias is a big problem in your field. You know, it's endemic in your field, right? That's the second condition. And the third condition was choose the best candidate for this position. By the way, racial and gender bias is an endemic problem in your field. And most people are trying to fight that, okay? And so what they found was in the first condition, they saw a certain level of racial and gender bias, as there is in hiring decisions. In general, right? The second condition where people were told that bias was endemic, actually the amount of bias increased because what it did is it primed people to think of bias as a normalized condition and it set a kind of peer pressure towards racial and gender bias, you know, strangely,
but it's weird.
A weird way that our minds work, right? It normalizes it as the thing that people are doing. The third condition actually eliminated bias because the thing that was normalized was the fact that most people are trying to fight it. That's the thing that became the kind of, default position, right? And so people worked and rose to meet that standard. And so that's something that we really have thought about a lot as we're doing this. I think it is important to demonstrate the existence of the issue of, you know, of racial, gender, bias and other forms of bias. It's important to demonstrate that that is a fact because otherwise it's difficult to see. But it's also important to always say the thing that we know to be true, which is that most people in this field desperately want to be just. We are in a field of, you know, do-gooder, like theater weirdos who know what it's like to be, you know, to be the kind of odd man out, you know. We're not in the field of, you know, the quarterbacks and the cheerleaders, right? I think we have a disproportionate amount of people who probably worried about getting a date for the prom and, you know, right? So we are in a, and we're in a field where I think empathy is the, it is the engine of our work, right? I know that we are in a field that wants to solve this problem, and I believe that we will solve this problem. It's just the fact is that we have to see it clearly.
Well, I think that's a really good note to end on, unless you have anything else you want to say.
No, but thanks for your coverage of gender parity in general and of the Kilroys in particular. We've really appreciated it.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for coming in today, Joy. It's been fun chatting with you on the air.
Thank you.
And we're back with some recommendations of things you should see, hear, read around the country or around the internets. Deep, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'm not lying. The first thing I did after finishing Cursed Child is watch a Harry Potter musical just to get that book off of my brain. And so I recommend, if you're feeling unhappy after being Cursed Child, you should go on YouTube, look up Star Kid Potter, a Harry Potter musical, and watch that. And then you will feel better about life and about the fandom that you devoted like 20 years of your life to. That's my recommendation. It's so funny. The songs are incredibly clever and catchy. And so it's just a great listening and watching experience. And so I recommend you do that if you have not done it, but I'm sure you have.
I'm going to recommend, this is a little bit left field for theater, but I think it works. Liz Merriweather, who was a playwright and now is a TV creator, has been doing some political election coverage for New York Magazine. She covered the RNC. And this week, she wrote an article that's basically a short story, and it's amazing, for NewYorkMag.com, called The Night Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton Created ISIS. And
oh, yes.
It is it is very much worth a read. It's an entertaining story. It's written by a playwright. And you should just Google that in New York Mag and you will find it. We'll put the link on the show page.
And I have two recommendations. The one is a bit on the nose. I recommend Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. Sorry. The other is, as of this recording, the latest cartoon from Good Tickle Brain, Hamilton Wait For It, which is fun. So take a look at that.
Which is, you know, a play on Lin-Manuel's Yay Hamlet, Hamilton thing.
Yes.
It's basically the lyrics to Wait For It, but
with Hamlet.
Hamlet.
Hamlet, yeah.
I recommend this article, How Mark Rylance Became Olivia on Stage. It's about Mark Rylance's becoming of Olivia in Twelfth Night. It's part of this series that Ben Brantley is doing. He's in London, I think initially to review the play we're talking about, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. But it's really, really a fascinating read. And if you haven't seen this production of Twelfth Night, also it was at the Globe. There's a DVD. It's amazing.
Yeah. And that's in the New York Times.
That's in the New York Times. Yeah. Yeah.
You might have heard of that paper.
Yeah. Wait, do we say cursed or cursed?
I thought it was cursed. But I didn't say anything.
I thought it was cursed.
I feel like
it's
heard
a very
cursed.
British. Yeah, it's a British
way. You say cursed, I say cursed, potato, potato.
Yeah, yeah.
And with that, that's our show for the week. Thanks for joining us. I hope you skipped the spoilers if you still want to read the play. Rate us on iTunes. It helps people find us. And check us out. Thanks for listening.